Last time we left off with the High Middle Ages. We were focused on understanding the development of the medieval church and the part that we probably are most typically familiar with, so the time period when the popes are at their height. So we looked at the investiture controversy, and we looked at monastic reform movements and different things like that. And today what we're going to do is this is going to be the first of at least three, and depending on how much ground I can cover in each lesson, possibly four lessons on the Reformation. Now, Reformation is not a time period that is going to be overly long. We might think of it as lasting maybe, if you want to talk about it lasting from when Martin Luther begins by posting his 95 Theses on the wall to the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. That ends the 30 Years' War and kind of sets the lines as far as Europe is concerned, religion-wise, for the next 200 years, 300 years or so. It's only about a 150-year period, a little bit less than that. We're going to spend about four lessons looking at it, and we're going to be spending this one looking at the time period really leading up to Luther, trying to understand how Luther comes about. Luther is a very interesting figure. The fact that the medieval church is able to be torn apart fairly easily at this time period is a very interesting event, and we're going to be trying to understand why that happens and kind of looking at the late medieval church leading right up to the time of Luther and getting into Luther himself too and seeing how he fits into all of this reform and agitation that's going on. So, a little bit of how we're going to structure this lesson is we're going to be talking about the weakened state of the church and the reasons for that. We're going to be looking at early attempts at reform. So we're going to go back and look at some of the later monastic reform movements, and we're going to look at a number of kind of precursors to Luther. So we're going to be looking at people like Wycliffe or Wycliffe, Huss, Savonarola, perhaps, if we have time to get to him. And we're also going to be looking at how the church solidifies its opposition to reform. It means how does the medieval church, the late medieval church, react to these reform movements? And that's going to be a large reason why the why Luther happens, is because of the way that the church reacts in the time against Luther himself and before that. And then we're going to look at the beginning of the Reformation. All right. So the reasons for reform are obvious. People during this time period were not in disagreement about whether the church needed to be reformed or not. That was not the issue at hand. The issue wasn't whether we should reform the church. The issue was, what does that look like? How do we go about doing that? And the real heart of this issue is the nature of the church that the popes have created. The popes have created a church and created positions for themselves where they are no longer the religious leaders of the church, but they are rather businessmen or secular rulers or political rulers. And so this is going to be the problem. The church is no longer being led in a way by people who are concerned with its spiritual welfare and the spiritual welfare of the people that they are responsible for. And this is not just going to be the case with the popes. The pope's attitude is going to carry down all the way down to the very level of the parish priests, bishops, abbots, different things like this. All of people are going to be affected by this kind of, the church is no longer a religious institution. Rather, it's a business or it's a political place for me to live, to be as a political appointee. So this is going to be the problem that we're going to be facing. Now, the church is going to be riddled not just with this, not with just this big kind of problem underneath it, this kind of philosophical problem that's going on in the church. The church is no longer a religious institution. But it's also going to be characterized by a number of abuses. We should probably just run through these very quickly and get you familiar with them. There's the abuse called simony, which is named for our old friend Simon Magus, who is the guy who supposedly started Gnosticism. This is the practice of paying for church office. Paying for church office. So this would have been the case with someone we're going to meet later, Albrecht of Mons, who is going to be the Archbishop, Luther's Archbishop at the time of the Reformation. He will have paid, or not, he would have paid more than this, but he would have borrowed from the Fugger bankers of Germany about 26,000 ducats as payment for him becoming the Archbishop of Mons. So he would have borrowed this and paid it to the Pope. So this is what's going on. Then there's pluralism. This is going to be holding more than one office at the same time. Albrecht's going to be guilty of this. Not only is he going to be the Archbishop of Mons, but he's going to also be the bishop of two other dioceses. But he pales in comparison to, say, someone like Cardinal de Tocqueville, who was the Archbishop of Rouen in France. He also was the bishop of three other dioceses. He was the abbey of four abbots and the prior of three priories. And he spent no time in any of these because his mission was to be a representative at the papal court in Italy. And just to show that this isn't just for the super wealthy, the princes of the church, if we want to think of them as this, cardinals, bishops. There's one English pastor who had 29 benefices. Or benefices, or however you want to say that word, where he's going to be just little church appointments. And 24 of those are going to involve the pastoral care of souls. So it's going to be he's the pastor of this parish or the pastor of this church, something like that. So he holds 24 of which involve being a pastor, and he's not even ordained. So even if he wanted to, and even if he chose to, he couldn't have done any of the jobs at any of the places where he was. Another problem that's going to stem from both of these is going to be non-residents. Obviously, if you are charged with being the bishop or the priest of more than one location, obviously it's not possible for you to be in two places at once. And so you have the possibility of non-residents where you're not even in one of the locations that you are supposed to be in charge of. And this goes way beyond just like, oh, I'm here and not here, and then I'm going to move around. Shouldn't think about it like that. Majority of these people were non-resident, period. The famous example is the French diplomat, Anton Duprat, was the Archbishop of Sens. And the only time, or the first time, I should say, and the only time, that he entered his cathedral was in his own funeral procession. So as a part of his own funeral, that was the first time that he entered his cathedral as the archbishop. So this is kind of the thing that we're looking at as far as, and this is going to be common throughout the church. This isn't just going to be common, like I said, for bishops, although it would probably be more common with those. If you want to look at the southern France, has about 25, 26 bishops. Only about 4 or 5 of them actually lived in their diocese. So only maybe 10, 20% bishops. So that's just one case. But this is another thing that this leads to, though, is going to be ignorance and poverty. If you have no bishops to kind of look over and guide the church, to kind of mentor and kind of make sure that the parish priests are kind of doing what they're supposed to do, then obviously this is going to lead to a lot of problems and a lot of possibility for false teachings to develop, possibility for people not to know what they're supposed to be doing and not have anywhere to go to find out what they should be doing. And so this is going to lead to ignorance and poverty. And also, because of non-residents, well, what do you do then for these churches where you have bishops or you have priests that are non-resident? Well, if the person was at least, you know, had a bare minimum of a conscience, he might appoint someone to take his place. Now, typically, this person would have been just hired off the, you know, oh, here's a priest, he can't afford or he doesn't have enough political connections to get his own appointment somewhere. So what he'll do is I'll give you, you know, a part of the money that I get from what you should receive for being the pastor of this church or the bishop of this place or something like that. You'll receive part of that, but not all of it. And sometimes they didn't even bother doing that. And so what this led to was the majority of these priests who filled the kind of everyday role that people saw, your local pastors or things like that, would have been the very poorest, the most uneducated. Many of these couldn't even read or write Latin. If they were, if they actually cared about their job, they might have at least memorized the Latin Mass, but most of them would not have known what they were saying. So obviously this is going to cause a problem. And it's also going to lead to poverty. They're not getting the money that is due them for holding this job. So what do they do to make their money? What they're going to have to do is they're going to have to charge the people of the parish for all the services that they render to them. So if you want to be married, well, that's going to be a fee. If your baby's going to be baptized, that's going to be a fee. Last rites, that's going to be a fee. Anything like this is going to cost you money. And this is going to start at the very bottom with your parish priest, and it's going to move all the way up to the top. And the fees will just get higher the higher you go. So non-residents is going to be a problem. And this is really going to lead, all of these first four things is really going to lead to something that's going to characterize late medieval European society. And this is going to be very, very rampant anti-clericalism, which is going to be this idea that the vast majority of people in Europe are going to be angry with the church. They're going to dislike priests. They're going to view them with suspicion. And they're going to, they're going to be one of the least popular types of people in all of Europe. These kind of poor, ignorant parish priests are going to be this. Now, other abuses, we're going to talk about these later somewhat, but indulgences, I can just go ahead and give you a brief kind of rundown so that when we come back to them later, we're going to hit them twice. One with Hus. Hus gets in trouble for some teachings against indulgences, and then obviously Luther is going to have this as well. So we might as well get kind of talking about this. Now, indulgences are really going to come into play in Europe with the Crusades. So when the Pope begins preaching the Crusades, one of the things that he does is he said, if you go on a crusade and you die in the state of confession and repentance, you are immediately granted access to heaven. Now, the belief in indulgences and a lot of what we're talking about is going to have to, you're going to have to understand the Catholic view on purgatory. So if you're a member of the church, obviously you'll get to heaven eventually, but depending on how many good works you do and all these other things, what kind of life you live, you could spend more or less time in purgatory. So one of the ways that you could make sure that you maybe got out of that was if you went on a crusade or something like that, a big type of thing that gave you a big indulgence. But then other little things, you could do little things for indulgences. You might ask for an indulgence and they say, well, if you go on this pilgrimage, we'll grant you an indulgence. We'll do this. Now, this is going to lead eventually to the act where if you donate a substantial sum of money to the church, maybe you'll get an indulgence. So we get to this very tricky point where it almost seems like we are paying for indulgences. Now, a couple of things that's different about what the church actually teaches about indulgences and what actually ends up being believed by maybe the common people about indulgences. Indulgences don't forgive sins. The Catholic Church officially never teaches that they forgive sins. They're only going to remit kind of the temporal effects that purgatory is going to have on you. They're not going to be purchased. You cannot purchase them for someone who's already dead, since one of the necessities of having an indulgence is that you're repentant. And an indulgence doesn't work unless you're repentant. Now, that's going to get lost on people as well. And obviously, the dead can't be repentant because they're dead, so it's not going to work for a dead person. And indulgences cannot be sown. They can only sold. They can only be freely given. Now, they can be freely given after you give something, but so we're going to see where this kind of disconnect is going to come in. And even though this is official church teaching, as the church becomes more and more corrupt, the church is going to emphasize less and less its actual teaching and is going to use the popular beliefs of the people in order to raise more and more money for itself. Another problem is going to be dispensations. Dispensations are going to be acts where the church can suspend church law for certain individuals. So let's say the church had a rule that if you were within 5 or 7 degrees of relation, you could not marry. Well, if you're a nobleman, that could be a lot of people. Nobles is a relatively small group, especially if you're a local group. To be 7 degrees of separation from someone is quite a big distance. So what you would have to do is you'd have to apply to the bishop, or, in fact, to the Pope, to get a dispensation to allow you to marry someone who is your fourth or fifth cousin, perhaps. Something like that. So, these are going to happen, and they're also going to happen especially for the illegitimate children of priests. It's going to be the typical area where we see these take place. Another area that's common. So, one thing that's common at this time period is concubinage of priests. This is also going to lead to this is another one of the abuses, although we might view this as just, this kind of celibacy is not really a biblical mandate. It's kind of enforced on the priests, and one of the ways that they go about dealing with that is through the act of concubinage, which they won't be actually married to them, but they will live with them throughout their lives, have children. But these children will be illegitimate, and they will not be recognized by the church or by the law. So one of the things you're going to have to do is you're going to have to go to the Pope and get a dispensation to recognize your child who's illegitimate. so that maybe he can become a priest, or he can go to the university or wherever else, so that he can be legally recognized as your heir. So this is one of the things that is going to happen. Now, one of the things to realize about this is that this cry for reform, we can look at this, all these abuses and everything that's going on, we can just say, oh, how awful late medieval society is. How just immoral and just, you know, this is just an awful time period to live in. But the fact that people are calling for reform is evidence not of a kind of a lack of care, a state of religious apathy. Actually, it's evidence that these people during this time period were very, very religious. Actually, as the church got less and less able to meet the religious needs of the people more and more wanted it, more and more desired to have their needs met because they weren't being met. They were hungry. They knew they were hungry. And so they're calling for reform. This is actually evidence that this is an extremely religious time period. Now, other problems that reform are going to begin with, we see the problems of the church are everywhere. So where do we begin? This is one of the problems that's going to take place. Everyone knew that the church needed to be reformed, but what do you do? Where do you go? Where do you start? How do you go about changing this? And the church is not going to be able to reform itself. The popes, despite all their claims to universal power and lordship, by this point in late medieval history, they've really lost much of the power that they even first claimed to have. After the Pope's conflicts with the King of France, Philip the Fair, the Pope is weakened. The papacy has moved to Avignon and is basically under the control of the French king for the next 70 years. The bureaucracy that the church has created in order to kind of govern and rule all that the church has created, the canon law, all of this stuff is too cumbersome to start just reforming very quickly and easily. And even if you had a person like a Hildebrand or a Boniface VIII or one of these great reformers that had come along earlier, even they probably would not have been able to reform the church in the way that it needed to be reformed. So the bureaucracy of the church is going to get in the way. The moral character of the popes. So even if we had had a pope that wanted to, which we obviously are not because of the type of moral lives that these popes are going to lead, any sort of ability that the popes would have had as kind of a moral leader for Europe is going to be squandered because of their openly immoral lives. To give you some examples of this, you have Sextus IV. He's a poor monk who somehow is appointed to be the pope, and he finds that he has no friends. So what does he do? He says, hey, all my family, come on and be cardinals. So he stacks the papal curia and the papal government with his own family members to protect himself, to give him allies within the church structure. Well, most of these people, only one of his, well, how should we say this? One of his relatives is reasonably competent, although not necessarily a great guy. He's competent. The rest of them are basically imbeciles who actually involve the pope in a plot to murder the Medici rulers of Florence at mass in their church. Innocent VIII is the first pope to openly acknowledge his own children and appoint them cardinals. And then that pales, of course, into the famous Alexander VI, the Borgia, who's the worst of all. He uses his papal power to continually get his own daughter out of marriages so that she can contract new marriages that brings the pope more power and money. He allows his son, Cesare, to create a hereditary kingdom within the papal lands. And he openly acknowledges mistresses and children while he's pope and grants positions of importance and power to his mistresses' families. Good guy. So any sort of ability that the popes might have had if you had had a morally upright pope to come to the papal throne at this time period, if you had had someone like that, it wouldn't have mattered because all the moral ability of the church to kind of speak into the everyday lives of people as a moral example or compass is squandered. If you want to know Machiavelli's famous quote, the Italians are the most irreligious and immoral people because that's where the church is. And they have a guide to their immoral and irreligious lives. They just look to the church. That's Machiavelli's famous statement. So, also in addition to this, so we have a bureaucracy that's unwieldy that the popes and the people that are trying to reform the church are going to have to come in contact with. We just have the moral character of the people in the church, by and large, is pretty low at this point, in high places, we should say. There are going to be a number of very devout, very religious, very righteous people who are going to be in the church. They're just not going to be in positions of authority. Or if they do make it to be a bishop or someone like that, they're not going to go on from there. They're going to be kind of a minority kind of opinion within the church. And then the popes, despite the increased volume of their claims to power and the ability to rule over kings and empires, they're going to have lost most of this ability. And they're going to do this because of the way that they went about trying to gain power in the first place. They tried to gain secular power, and then it's going to be very easy because the Pope is not going to ever be a very powerful secular ruler. And the only weapons he's going to have, the weapons of excommunication or interdict against areas, those are going to lose their effectiveness the more times that you use them. So the first time that you excommunicate someone, they might really take that seriously. The fourth or fifth time, probably not so much. So the ability for excommunications and different things like that to take place are going to weaken. And then the popes are going to be under the power of kings. Like we said, we have the papal, we're going to have the Babylonian captivity of the church where the popes are removed to France. And they're going to be under the power of the French king. So we have all of this. Now, we're going to have early reform movements that we're going to be able to talk about here very quickly. We won't be able to spend a lot of time on these. But in the beginning of this time period, when this is just beginning, we're going to have a number of people who attempt to reform the church. People like Francis, Dominic. We're going to have the Brotherhood of the Common Life or the Modern Devotion. We're going to have mysticism that's going to arise out of this. We have the Beguines, and then we're going to have people that begin to move outside the Catholic Church. So all these first groups are obviously going to remain inside the Catholic Church. But with the Waldensians, we begin to get groups and sects that are going to start moving outside the Catholic Church and be able to sustain themselves and remain intact, at least for periods of time. So Francis, if we move to Francis, Francis is going to be born the son of a wealthy cloth merchant. He's going to live the life of a playboy in his youth. He's going to have a religious conversion. And the big thing that Francis and a number of people, these early reformers, are going to criticize about the church is the wealth of the church. And they're going to criticize that by this living this life of poverty. So it's not really clear what Francis intended for the group of people that followed him other than just being poor together and using that example of poverty to go and minister to other poor people, to preach and care for them. But what's going to happen is as soon as Francis dies, what's going to happen is the Franciscans, just like everyone else, are going to start to accumulate property and become wealthy. And now, that's not going to be the case with all the Franciscans. You're going to have Franciscans who try to maintain their ideal of poverty, but they're going to be condemned by the church and forced to change or to be killed. So you have Francis, who's going to come into this. You're going to have Dominic, who's going to look at the ignorance of the church. The church of this time period is going to be characterized by a lot of just bad thinking, bad teaching. And so, in a trip through southern France, he's going to meet with a number of people who are there suppressing the Cathar or Albigensian heresy at the beginning of the 1200s. And he's going to realize that these people are not capable of kind of conversing or converting or teaching these people in any way that's convincing. So he's going to say, what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to live not just lives of poverty, which he's going to emphasize as well, but you're also going to have to be very, very well educated. So you're going to have the Dominican friars, which are going to come around, and is going to be combating heresy through preaching, and that's going to be through study and through lives of poverty. But the same thing's going to happen to them. They're going to accumulate property. They're going to accumulate roles of importance inside universities and other things, and they're going to become corrupt just like everyone else eventually. So what you're going to see is a lot. Oftentimes, these movements that attempt to reform the church, if they become really part of the church, they're going to get sucked up into the wealth and the problems that the church offers. They're not going to really be able to fully reform it. They're good for a while, but they're only as good as their leadership is going to allow them to be. So as long as you have a Dominic or a Francis around, who's very charismatic and is very forceful and is able to kind of push through his idea, you might have some chance of some change. But if you don't have someone like that, and once they die, that's going to quickly fade. Next up, we have what's going to be a lay movement within the Catholic Church of Reform. This is the Brotherhood of the Common Life. It's going to be founded by a guy by the name of Gerard Groot. And he's going to, he once was an ambitious cleric who kind of steps aside from that to become a spiritual leader. And he's going to emphasize two things. He's going to look at the church and see that the church is not really meeting the needs of the people. And he's going to say, what is the essence of the Christian life? The essence of the Christian life is an inward personal communion with God. That's what we're after. That's what the church is not supplying us with. So that's what we're going to do, is we're going to foster this together by living in a community together. They're not going to take vows. They're not going to become an organized order. They're just going to be a bunch of lay people who could include some priests as well. And eventually that becomes more and more of the people that they attract, or clerics and priests and monks and different things like that. So they're going to live together. They're going to do their work together, normal work that you would find everyday people doing. Mostly they're going to be copying books and making manuscripts before the invention of the printing press. And the only way to test this kind of inward devotion that we have is through what are our outward acts of moral action and service to those around us. So something very similar to what we're going to see preached later, a very moral kind of inward religious movement. And they're going to create many, many schools. That's going to be one of the big areas. And the Brotherhood of the Common Life is really going to be an organization that spreads throughout Holland and northern Germany. And a lot of what it's going to do is going to look at this, trying to reform the church very slowly through education and through just their acts, their righteous lives. It's kind of a different way of looking at reforming the church. And it's going to remain influential. We're going to have a number of people. Erasmus is going to go to a Brotherhood of the Common Life school and be influenced by them. Luther will be influenced by some of their work as well. All right. So why does all this fail in the end? The bloated structure of the canon law. And then the problem of wealth. The church is wealthy, and that's where its power comes from. The power of the church derives from its wealth. We looked at last week. The power of medieval Christianity comes from two things: the ability to give gifts and the ability to give justice. That's where power at this time period comes from. And if the church isn't wealthy, then it has no ability to do this. One of these aspects, anyway, it doesn't have the ability to do. And that's going to lead them to this desire to create more wealth so they can have more power, so that they can have more influence over kings and other things like that. Money is essential to the Pope maintaining his gifts. And it doesn't just become essential to gaining more power. It becomes essential to keeping the power that they have and keeping the lifestyle that they have. The church has created this huge bureaucracy of cardinals and archbishops and people who don't really do a whole lot. And all those people have to be maintained, because they're aristocrats, in the style of life to which they are accustomed. And that means heavily taxing the churches, and that means the sale of indulgences to raise more money when we go in debt. One of the things that's going to be problematic during the time period that we're talking about is the amount of debt that the Pope accumulates. By the time we get to the time of Luther, the Pope is about 125,000 ducats in debt in his building projects and different things like that. Through the wars of his successor and a number of other things, he's become heavily indebted. And so that's going to influence how he looks at Luther. Here he's got this scheme. He's going to raise money. He's going to pay off some of his debts. And here's this monk up in Germany causing problems. If he would just be quiet, we could get all this done and it would be okay. But that's because he is a businessman and a political leader. He's not a religious leader anymore. He's not concerned with the religious state of the church. He's concerned with his balance sheet and his political connections. And this is the political ties. The church not only is a physical worldly ruler through its control of the papal states, but through its ties with other lands, political ties and its ability to enforce sometimes political decisions that it wants, or at least attempting to, the church has really worked itself into a situation where it either has to continue doing what it's doing in attempting to do this, or it's going to have to, like it did during the time period of the Avignon Papacy, submit to being controlled by an outside ruler and have its decisions and its methods and its practices forced on it. This is the whole thing that the medieval church has fought so long to keep from doing. The medieval church was ruled by emperors, right? We looked at Constantine and we looked at the investiture controversy where kings and emperors were able to appoint the members of the church in their lands. And the Pope didn't have any control over them. So they were appointing very just worldly, wealthy people to take these lands that they had donated so that they could get them back when they died. They used the church as kind of a way of maintaining their imperial property rights to certain pieces of land and yet still gaining the benefit of being able to give it as a gift and then get it back and then give it as a gift and get it back. And this really decreased the freedom of the Pope to create any sort of reform or control the church in these lands. So the church really is caught in a problem here because of the choices that it's made. It's gone down this road so far. We talked a little bit about this imagery last week, too. The church has gone down a road, and it might have realized, I don't like where I am anymore. But one of the things that the popes have kind of done is through their claims to infallibility and the ability of the church never to err, anytime they make a decision, it's a big decision, they're really locked into it. They can't really change it. And there's going to be one movement that we're going to talk about in a minute that's going to try and undo that, but that movement, unfortunately, is not really going to get off the ground. Now, another problem that the church is undergoing during this time period is the schism. This happens when the Avignon Papacy attempts to come back to Rome. I'll give you a brief kind of rundown of what happens. The Pope comes back to Rome and dies. So they're going to elect a new Pope. Now, most of the cardinals at this time, since the Pope has been French for about 70 years, are all French. So they're all meeting in Rome, and a mob forms outside the papal palace and says, basically, elect an Italian or you're all dead. So, of course, they do the thing that you would do in that situation. They elect an Italian. This is going to be, the Italian. I moved to the wrong page of my notes. The Italian Pope is going to be, Urban VI. And this might have worked out well if Urban VI had been a halfway decent Pope. Unfortunately, he was violent, arrogant, and probably mentally imbalanced. I don't know why they elected him in the first place. Maybe that was the best that they had of the Italians at the time. Or maybe that's just what all Italians are. No, just joking. And so they leave one by one. They all kind of slip out of Rome. And then reappear back in Avignon and say, hey, that election that we just had there in Rome, that doesn't really count. It was under duress. We're electing a new pope. He's going to be Clement VIII. And this is how bad Urban was. Even the Italian bishops and cardinals back in Rome got out of Rome and came to Avignon and said, yeah, we're with you guys. And so that kind of left Urban in a difficult situation. So he just appointed a whole new batch of cardinals and bishops. And now we have two popes, one in Rome and one in Avignon. And they're both claiming to be pope. Obviously, both excommunicate the other. And what you end up having happen is that we're not really looking at the kind of theoretical who's right and who's wrong. What ends up happening is Europe divides along political lines, some siding with one pope, some siding with the other, not based on who they think is right, but who they think, who their political enemies are siding. So France, Scotland, Spain, and southern Italy back Clement VIII in France, and then Ireland, England, and most of Germany, who are enemies of France and Scotland and southern Italy, are going to back the Pope in Rome. Now, this situation is not just going to last during the lifetime of these two popes when they die. Their little curias are going to elect new popes, and this is just going to continue. And while we might laugh and chuckle at this kind of silly situation, this is gravely important for the people who are living there in this time period. If you're backing a wrong pope and you die, well, that's it for you. Bye-bye. No purgatory, no nothing. You're just going straight to hell. That's all that there is to it. So this is a grave situation at the time period for average people. All right? So this is going to lead to calls for reform, and this is going to be the rise of the conciliar movement. And this is what I was talking about just a minute ago, where now for the first time in a while, the church has the ability to maybe undo some of the problems that the popes have created during the Middle Ages. And this is going to be through councils. People are going to propose, William of Ockham and a number of other people are going to propose that popes are not the ultimate source of authority in the church. No, it's councils are the ultimate source of authority in the church. And what we're going to have is a number of councils started. Unfortunately, the first council that gets called doesn't have enough support, and all it does is create a third pope who promptly excommunicates the other two, and they, in turn, excommunicate him. And so now we have three popes going along. But eventually, this situation is going to become so bad, the German emperor and a number of other people are going to get together and say, get the third pope, he's going to call a council. And this is going to be the Council of Constance. And we'll come back to the Council of Constance in a minute. Here's the Council of Constance, that's John Huss there in the middle, being condemned by the council. But they're going to call a meeting. And John the 23rd, the Pope, the third Pope, is going to step down and abdicate. And the council, with enough political backing, is going to force both the other popes to step down, or if they don't step down, just to shove them to the side and not really pay attention to them anymore. And they're going to elect a new pope. And so the schism is going to be over. Unfortunately, though, the conciliar movement really doesn't take off. Even though the conciliar movement passes measures saying that it's the ultimate source of authority and the pope has to call it at least every 10 years, you have to have a new council, because there hadn't been a council up until Constance for 100 years. So it had been a long time since they had had a council. Even though they do this, what ends up happening is the next major council to meet, the council at Basel in Switzerland, well, all it's going to do is start a new schism, because the pope isn't going to be supporting it, so they're going to excommunicate the pope and appoint a new pope. So we're back in the same situation again. So everyone just says, forget conciliarism, it's not going to work, and we're just going to go back with the popes again. So any sort of attempt that the councils might have had to kind of overcome this papal authority is really squandered through their own... I mean, they're just kind of over-eager. They're trying to push things probably a little bit too quickly. They get a little too radical. They alienate a lot of people, and that ends up being the death of it. Now, we have a number of reformers. During this time period of schism and problems that are going on, we have a number of reformers that are going to grow up, because the church is kind of going to be, their attention, let us say, is going to be divided and looking elsewhere. So we have a number of opportunity for reformers to grow up. We have John Wycliffe, Jan Hus, and Savonarola are going to be the two. And I probably won't have, I'm not going to have time to talk about Savonarola, but I will talk about Wycliffe and Hus. Wycliffe is an Oxford theologian, and he's going to become important because he's going to defend the right of the state to govern the church inside its territory. He's a theologian, he's at Oxford, but he's going to say the church has no right, the pope has no right to kind of run the church in a country. The king has that right. Obviously, that makes the king very happy with him. And even though the church is going to work to have him removed, the king is going to protect him, because it's always good to have a theologian who backs you up and who is very articulate and very wise. And not only this, but he's going to be incredibly austere. He's going to emphasize poverty, emphasize rectitude of life. How you live is important. He's going to be very, very popular. Now, eventually, though, he's going to claim Scripture as the only authority. He's going to deny the authority of the Pope. He's going to begin calling the Pope the Antichrist, which is kind of common among Protestants for a long time after this. And he's going to emphasize poverty. We talked about this. Now, eventually, his reforms and his thoughts are going to take him outside what the king is willing to kind of tolerate, and the political situation is going to change in England. And he's going to be kind of sent into exile in northern England, but he's going to be allowed to live. And he dies peacefully. Only one out of the early guys that make it that far. Now, his body's not going to make it out unscathed, but he will. And we're going to go on and look at his importance. His importance is going to be, for the first time, he's going to translate the Bible, at least the New Testament anyway. The Old Testament is going to be translated by one of his disciples. But the English New Testament is going to be available in English. Now, this is not going to be our English yet. It's going to be Middle English. So, not quite. You wouldn't want to pick up a Wycliffe Bible and probably start reading it. It would probably be a little difficult. But he's going to lead to one of the early Christian sects that are going to kind of exist outside the mainstream Catholic Church until the Reformation gets started. And these are going to be the Lollards. We don't really know where their name comes from. It could mean that Lollards meant mumblers because they mumbled under their breath or something like that. But his disciples, these Lollards, are going to spread his teaching and his translation of the Bible all across Europe. It's going to become very, very influential. All right? Now, Wycliffe's influence and his writings are going to be carried to the kingdom of Bohemia. And this is because the half-sister of the king of Bohemia married the English king. And so we have a political connection that exists between Bohemia, which is far off in East Germany, and England, which doesn't seem like a logical place that you're going to have a connection, but that's going to happen. You're going to have a number of Czechs who move and go from Bohemia and go to London to study at Oxford. And they're going to bring back Wycliffe's writings, and they're going to influence a professor and pastor in Prague by the name of Jan Hus. And he's going to translate a lot of Wycliffe's writings into Czech. And he's going to attempt, and he's going to begin preaching reform of the Catholic, of the church and that. And one of the big demands that you're going to have with the Hussites, and Hus is going to be the man for communion in both kinds. So up until this time, up until Vatican II, actually, the Catholic Church only allowed lay members to have communion in one kind. You could have the bread, but not the wine. Now, the bishop is going to actually excommunicate Hus, not for any sort of his theological beliefs, but because Hus is going to back a different pope in this time period of papal schism than the bishop backs. And he's going to draw further anger when he fails to back one of the popes in issuing an indulgence for a crusade against one of the other popes. So one of the popes says, we need to have a crusade against that other bad pope. And Hus doesn't go along with that. So he's going to be he's going to be excommunicated. He's going to be asked in 1414 to appear before the Council of Constance. He's going to be given a safe passage there. Unfortunately, the emperor is convinced by the people against Hus that you don't have to honor a deal made with a heretic. He's going to be imprisoned and he's going to be burned at the stake when he fails to recant his beliefs. Now, one of the interesting things about this, we wouldn't probably remember Hus a whole lot if things hadn't happened differently. The people of Bohemia erupt in revolt. They're incensed that their great famous pastor has been burned and imprisoned, killed, and so they rise in revolt. And even though five different separate crusades are launched against the people of Bohemia, they defeat all five of them and are able to remain an independent church until the time of the 30 Years' War, when unfortunately for them, things are going to take a different turn. But 100 years after Hus, 90% of Bohemia or Czechoslovakia, modern-day Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia, is going to be Hussite. So 90% of the population is going to become Hussite. So we're not going to have time to talk about Savonarola, but Savonarola is going to be in Italy. He's also going to be someone who preaches against the excesses of the church. And just like Hus, he's going to be burned. And this is really going to lead us up to the problem of the reformer. And the problem of the reformer is going to be that anytime you attempt to reform the church, what you're going to have is you're going to run up against the authority of the church. And anytime that you fight against religious authority, that's a very easy way for the church to come down on you and say, oh, you're a heretic because you're denying papal or church authority. And what ends up happening is this is really the only effective weapon that the church has of suppressing a reformer. And all they're going to say is, oh, you're going against church authority, so you're a heretic and we're going to burn you. And so the church really doesn't have any kind of theological, not anything well-defined anyway yet. That's going to change with the Counter-Reformation. But right now there's no good theological argument against what the ideas that the reformers are going to wage. Another thing that's very interesting is almost all the early reform movements are not theologically based. No one is trying to really change church doctrine at the beginning. Everyone's just out for practical reform. Let's get rid of simony. Let's get rid of indulgences. Let's get rid of all these things, these kind of tangible, evident problems. But they're not really looking behind that to any sort of theological kind of or doctrinal issues. And so what you have developing is, depending on the way that the church responds, you can have people that say the exact same thing. And one of them is made a saint and one of them is burned as a heretic. So depending on the people that are over them and around them in authority within the church, they're going to be treated differently. And what you really get a sense of is the Catholic Church at the time of Luther is really a rotten tree. It might look really strong and look monolithic on the outside, but things are rotten on the inside. And all it's going to take is someone who is able to articulate his beliefs very forcefully and get political and popular backing, and the church will probably come apart at the seams. And I'm going to stop there because we only have a few minutes left, and I'll get to Luther and Erasmus next week. But are there any questions? Right now we have about 2 or 3 minutes left. I'm at a good stopping spot. Do you have any questions about the early reformers? I only got to touch on them, I know, briefly, but there's a lot here trying to set the stage for the Reformation. All right, nothing? Okay. Well, then I'll pray and we'll be dismissed. Father, we thank you for those who have gone before us, who have fought and cared for your church. We pray that we will learn from their examples, that we will, like them, care for the sanctity and the purity of your church and work to make sure that any sort of abuses or problems that appear in it, we are able to fight and remove from our midst. And we thank you for their example and for their wealth of knowledge that they have given us so that we don't have to go and do this, fight these fights, hopefully again. And it's in the name of your Son we pray. Amen.